what I'm trying to do in the book and what I'm doing with the book since it's come out.
Okay. And yes, I'm glad that Eric pointed it out. I remember when I was invited by Alan to do the prophetic voice, and I had a great time that evening. I decided to, for the first time, it was my first public lecture on the book, and I let it rip, my criticism. So the idea comes way back. During the sex abuse crisis here in Boston, I found myself as a Catholic moral theologian and a priest in Boston having to address all sorts of institutional problems with one of the two major institutions that teach ethics, the church. And as we were doing that, there was another Jesuit who was raising a question, and that was Frank Clooney, and he kept saying, you know, we should be talking about the church, but we should be talking about the academy as well. In fact, he even basically said that we shouldn't really have the church of the 21st century. We should have the university of the 21st century, because we should be prepared for scandals that come from the university the way they've come from the church. And I thought, that strikes me right. And then I began to put my ear to the ground to look at different things that were happening. And what I began to see was that at the university, there were all sorts of different issues being raised. One thing I did is I began to read a great deal on it. And the only thing that was really being written about the university were about professors and their relationships with mostly women students. The Lecherous Professor is a very famous book that came out where two women professors tried to just simply say that there was something uncanny about the university, that predatory professors was somehow scot-free able to do these things. Then more questions were raised about professors. It would be about even issues about letters of recommendation or maybe not having office hours. But suddenly there was a little bit of ethics being raised about the professor. Nothing about the university. Nothing. So if you were to look at all the books that were written on what was called academic ethics, there's nothing on adjunct faculty. Not, there are volumes on academic ethics. It's about the professor and his relationship with their students and the contracts that are implicit to their work, but nothing about anyone else at the university, including non-tenure track faculty, which now constitute the majority in many universities of the faculty. So this was a very limited framework. The question was, let's try to bring in ethics for the professor, and that's to be praised. And there was a person named Stephen Kahn who did a book 30 years ago called Scamps and Saints and the University, and it came out 5 years ago, the 25th anniversary. And he developed a whole series of books that were, again, about academic ethics, but not what I'm calling university ethics. And that is that I began to see all sorts of problems at the university, but no one was saying that it being at the university is the issue, that there's something about the institution of the university itself that lacks any consciousness of ethics, or that there is a culture of ethics that needs to be developed there. So what did I start looking at? You know, I started looking at the adjunct faculty. That was the first thing I started doing. I started reading anything I could. I would follow Mary Maisto, who founded the new faculty majority. I began to look at what the Inside Higher Ed was publishing, what the Chronicle was publishing about adjunct faculty. I started following this question of professors of the practice that was developing here. But I began to see all sorts of different narratives that were occurring all around the country. So I had this question about adjunct faculty. Then sports. I live with Ken Himes. I live with David Hollenbach. I also live with John Paris. And when I told them what I was doing, they bought this right away. So every morning I'd come down to breakfast and they would tell me some sports scandal. And guess where those scandals were? They were at universities. They were not down at Red Sox Nation. They were not down at the Yankees. They were at Brown or Harvard or Penn State or UPenn. They were at universities. And I kept looking at this. And then I began to say, I want to stay away from just football. I want to look at basketball. And then I began to study what did it mean to be a student and play and an athlete at a university? And there was nothing cohesive there. There was no ethics on this. Then I started looking at faculty oversight committees at all these universities. They were pathetic. It was often enough the university oversight committee that negotiated changing grades to make an athlete able to play. It was faculty on these committees who never had any guidance, but who always were answerable to the president of their school. And they were somehow building the bridge between the student who was now put on suspension because of lack of academic performance or not getting sufficient support or whatever. And it was these faculty oversight people who were actually negotiating a change in grade so that the athlete could play and that the athlete's own academic education was taking second bar. It was faculty collaborating on this. When I started doing sports, it was just great. When I finished the book, I still could not get a whole chapter out on sports because it was more going to be a book. I concluded the book with a case of a ninth grader girl who's being recruited for women's soccer against every standard of ethics that there is. They're trying to recruit this girl to come to their school 4 years later to play on their team. And it was an article in the New York Times, a full-page article, just showing you how I didn't have to do football. I didn't have to do baseball. I didn't have to do basketball. I could do women's soccer. In other words, anything in athletics could really be a way of saying, is there something wrong at home at the university? Taylor Branch, while I was finishing my book, Taylor Branch is doing his work on what's happening at sports and the university, how it's tied to issues of race and class as well. And how, at some universities, a student is only there for a year so that he can be picked to play in a major league. Then I wanted to look at students behaving badly. So I hired quite a number of my presidential scholars to be resource. I learned a lot about Jezebel. I learned about a lot of links that our students checked and that most of our faculty heard nothing about. And when I started reading about these race parties, when I started reading about these whole parties, when I started reading about these theme parties that were either racially or sexually really kind of charged and what was happening on it, I found that really disturbing. But then I wanted to find out more about history. I wanted to find out about the history of the university. And I found this book that really influenced me a great deal by Helen Lefkowitz. She wrote it about 45 years ago. It's called Campus Life. And in it, she says that the American campus is like what the Harvard narrative was, that before the Revolution, there were a bunch of Puritan sons, ministers' sons, who were looking for a degree, and they were taught theology and ministry. They were treated terribly, according to her. They usually had their instructor who also owned the house that they were staying in and also prepared the food that they had to eat. There was, if you will, no exit for them, and they had a miserable existence on the campus, which was basically to become a minister. With the American Revolution, things changed. All the way back with the American Revolution comes a whole new class of students. These she calls campus students. They're sons of business people. That now that they've gotten rid of the British and now the American colonies are beginning to move forward, they need to make sure that they have well-educated young men who can run the businesses. They were basically, you know, we wonder whether business schools have a place in the university. It's really what the university appreciating that its roots are business. I mean, if you do any sort of work on this. And what they found was that these guys were fearless with regard to their host. They beat them. They burnt them. They killed them. Their attitude was, my father's paying for this, and he's not going to punish me. And there was a new attitude of rowdyism at the university that starts right after the American Revolution. that it's so rowdy that they begin to form these different classes, that they have these battles on the field where they just work out all their testosterone. And they have such big fights that there's all these famous gatherings. This is where university football starts. But one of the things that she argues is that when we talk about fraternity life or students behaving badly today, she says the ground for this was the American university. The fraternity could not have found another place. It grew naturally as an extension of what life at the university was. We have this whole belief, because we've walked through Harvard Yard, that universities were always these nice, you know, fields of green and these nice young men who were wanting all to be Puritan ministers and everything was serene. There were ruffians. They were beating one another. They were beating their teachers. They were beating their monitors. They were doing this on a regular basis. She talks about how later on when women came, they had to make a decision whether they'd be like the men or whether they would like to stay off campus and get off-campus housing, which is really what they always had to do. But her book, Helen Lefkowitz's Campus Life, opened me up to investigate this. And the more I investigated it, the more I found that her narrative was true. I think we have this idea that the American university had this really, you know, I don't know where these fraternities came from. I don't understand this. I never saw conduct like this before. It was there from 1780, according to her. And I think that that's important. So the chapter that most people like in my book is the chapter that's called Students Behaving Badly. I actually think it is not the best chapter in my book. I think the best chapter in my book is the fifth chapter. This is a chapter in which I talk about the vocation of the professoriate and the geography of the university. The vocation of the professoriate is that I have a very good friend. His name is Marsh Carter. He was the CEO of State Street, and he was CEO of the New York Stock Exchange. He goes occasionally to lecture at CSUN. He says whenever he goes to CSUN, he cannot get over the fact that faculty are in offices by themselves. He is in the big business world. It's all collaboration. He's on major hospital boards. He sees nurses working together. He sees doctors in teams. He has plenty of lawyers. He sees lawyers are in teams. He thinks that the police in his neighborhood, they're partners. He sees firemen and firewomen. He sees how they work as a ladder company. He sees collaborative work. When he comes to the university, he sees a bunch of individuals who are teaching individually, grading people individually, evaluated individually, and there's not a jot of any collectivity. The vocation of the professoriate is to become the best student that they once were, and that is to be able to get the best grade in the class, and they'll do that as they become teachers. And they will teach their students to be the same thing, nothing collaborative. I read a lot of Derek Bach, and Bach keeps writing about why do professors think that lecturing is the best way to proceed when we know that it is the least effective mode. He says, because the vocation of the professoriate is to do her or his own thing. At the same token, I was looking at the geography of the university. The university, you know, no one knows what's happening at the university. So I live with Ken and David across the street on Beacon Street, 246 Beacon, right across from McGuinn. All right, so I can go for a walk anywhere around here. I suggest most people go for a walk and sit on the steps of St. Mary's until from midnight to 4 a.m. on a Friday morning. In other words, Thursday night to Friday morning. You will have a whole new impression about why our students are behaving badly and why they're not in class on Friday morning. You will also begin to learn that Van der Slice is not the name of a pizzeria because it's the dorm right across the street from you. But there's a certain way that the university's faculty have made sure that what happens in the classroom and what happens in the dorms remain where they were. There's an insularity that student affairs basically runs the student lives in the dorms and in their extracurricular activities, and anything intellectual happens, and God knows what that means, because they're not bringing in their personal lives, they're not bringing in their friendships, they're not bringing in any relationships, nor anything else they're doing on campus, but their intellectual life is being formed by the university professor who does not know where they live, nor how it is that they have to go through one of the most arcane structures to move each year from one year to another and do housing, which at BC is nightmarish if you listen to students cry in front of you about how they lost their friendship. And we're talking about a university that's men and women for others. So this deep disconnect that the faculty don't know anything about student affairs. Well, student affairs know nothing about the faculty. And the police don't know about either. And the health services don't. And all the other different parties here don't. The only people who know what's happening are the president, who has an aerial view, and the student, who knows all the different commodified services that he or she can get and broker. But the rest of us, we don't. We're siloed. We're not just siloed in our schools, we're siloed in our departments. And if we're professors of the practice, we could be siloed from the rest of the faculty in our department. And if we're adjunct, not even a professor of the practice, there's another whole issue that's going on there. The nature of the university is not to be transparent, because the nature of the university follows the model of the professoriate, which is to work alone. And these conspire to make us have an institution that is medieval. There is nothing really modern about the university. It goes back to its medieval roots. I'm teaching in this class, in this room, at 2 o'clock today, Abelard's Ethics. It goes back to Abelard, the notion that one man or one woman teaches one group of people and actually can, like Abelard, run a university and be the university. But that is not for the 21st century. So I believe that the culture of the university, in terms of its geography, in terms of the fact that only vice presidents, not even deans, really know what's happening at the university. They only know what's happening at their school. But they do not know what a vice president knows, to say nothing what the president knows, or what the student knows. We are so siloed that there is no way to have a communication to know what would constitute a culture of ethics. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm not looking for norms. I'm not looking for... that's later. I'm interested in a culture of ethics, that somebody will read something about something happening. Like about a year and a half ago, I heard microaggressions. So somebody came up with this idea that we were going to post that any student who felt a microaggression had occurred, that they were to report it to this one office where it would be put online. Now, as an ethicist, David is an ethicist, and Ken is an ethicist, and Eric is an ethicist, there's about 12 of us on this campus who are experts, but none of us would ever be asked about any university policy and whether or not it is ethical. But when I was thinking of a public denunciation without any attrition and any transparency and any accountability just being put up, I thought, only at a university. This would not happen at IBM. This would not happen. Why? Because they study business ethics. It would not happen at a hospital because they study nursing ethics or medical ethics. It would not happen at other institutions. The only place that this would happen is at a university, because the university has no interest in ethics. So that's where I'm at. And I've done the book. It's come out. I've been writing about it. I had two terrible things happen to me. The book came out 3 days after my best friend died, and that was in May, Lucas Chan. We were also going to be collaborating together, and he was supposed to be doing quite a bit of work of editing two books, so I'm now editing his two books. I ended up teaching his courses, and he was running a conference with another fellow in June in Bangalore, so I ended up having to gather the conference together and do it. So the book comes out 3 days after my friend dies at 46 of a heart attack while teaching at Marquette. Really extraordinary person that, like David and Ken knew very well. And so I'm dealing with just grief at that time. I'm also living in Asia for 3 months because I went to bury him in Hong Kong, where he was from, and then stayed in India teaching his courses and running his conference. And I came back here at the end of August to begin school and to also edit these two books of his that were outstanding. And then I finished the book, the first book, and I was about ready to do the second. And I was traveling with Kathy Bailey and 19 others for a fabulous week in Managua. And 2 weeks ago, while we were getting ready for the plane, I slipped and fell, and my knee went back, caught the corner of the chest, and ripped the patella, which is called your kneecap, off. And Kathy was there, she heard me screaming. And that was 2 weeks ago. So I was supposed to be addressing the entire, Association of Catholic Colleges and Universities, all the chief academic offices. This was set up about a year ago. And that was supposed to be last Thursday. I didn't do that, obviously. I was supposed to be at LMU. I was supposed to be at Fairfield. I was supposed to be at Georgetown. All these have been canceled until I can walk, which will be in another 2 weeks. So I'm really happy that I finally have an audience that I can talk my work on, because I've been looking for one for 8 months. And as a matter of fact, all these appointments have been set, you know, to later dates. But I am interested. We're hosting in August and April 2017, the Jesuit Institute, a conference on university ethics, where we want to bring in people like Ruth Simmons, the president of Brown, whom I talk a great deal about in the book. We want to get Derek Bach, if he's still in good health, to come over. We've talked to Helen Lefkowitz. We've been talking to a number of people to do a whole conference on university ethics. I've been talking to a group of adjunct faculty who are connected to the Society of Christian Ethics and the Society of Jewish Ethics to see if they could be participants, but it's going to be a national 4-day conference here in the first week of April in 2017. But now the floor is finally open.